So I was doing a book signing the other day, and somebody came up to me and said, you gotta do a video on the Chili Queens of San Antonio. And I was so intrigued by that phrase alone, the Chili Queens of San Antonio, that I decided, yeah, I do need to do a video on that, so here it is. And with that, I am making a Texas-style chili using a recipe from 1910. So thank you to Babbel for sponsoring this video as I talk about chili and its Texas queens, this time on Tasting History. The immensely quotable Will Rogers once called chili con carne a bowl of blessedness. And while I agree, I wonder exactly what type of chili Will Rogers was talking about, because there are so many variations on this dish, and everyone seems to think that their variation is the right one. But nobody is so vehement as the Texans when it comes to their chili being the right version, so I am making a Texas-style chili. This recipe comes from the first producer of chili powder, the Gephardt Chili Powder Company. Cut 2 pounds of beef into 1/2-inch squares, add about 2 ounces chopped tallow, then salt it. Heat 2 tablespoons of lard, add to this a small-sized chopped onion. When the onion is about half done, add the meat. Stir well until the meat is separated and white, then let steam over a rather hot fire, stirring frequently until the juice of the meat is boiled down. And when it starts to fry, add about 1 1/2 pints of hot water, 3 tablespoonsful of Gephardt's Eagle chili powder, and a few buttons of chopped garlic. Stir well and let simmer until meat is tender. So this recipe is pretty basic, which is how most old recipes for chili are, and again, since I don't want a bunch of angry Texans, I have opted for one that does not include beans actually in the chili, because Texans do not put beans in their chili today. Though if you look back through history, most of the recipes from the 19th and early 20th century, at least a good deal of them, actually include the beans in the chili, even when they are from Texas. Let the fighting commence in the comments. Another fight-inducing thing about chili is exactly where it came from. Is it American or is it Mexican? And I actually tend to fall on the side of it being Mexican, because it probably got its form as it is today in Texas, but probably when it was still Mexico. But don't tell that to the author of the 1959 edition of the Diccionario de Mexicanismos, who claimed that chili was a detestable food passing itself off as Mexican, sold in the US from Texas to New York. A dictionary with some very strong opinions, though you wouldn't need such a biased dictionary if you learned Spanish for yourself with a little help from our sponsor today, Babbel. Babbel is one of the top language learning apps in the entire world, and it's fantastic because the lessons are nice and short, 5 to 10 minutes, so no matter how busy your schedule is, you can always get a lesson in every day. I've used it to brush up on languages that I've already a little knowledge of, like French, je me souviens maintenant, as well as learning a language from the ground up, like Spanish, pero aún sigo aprendiendo. And the lessons, which are created by actual language teachers rather than an AI, help you prepare for real-life conversations. So they're perfect for if you're going to be traveling abroad or have business with people who speak in another language, or if you're just trying to learn a new language to better yourself, because education is just a good thing. So to get started speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks, then sign up for Babbel using my link in the description or scan this QR code up here in the corner, and you'll get 60% off of your subscription along with Babbel's 20-day money-back guarantee. Now, back to this chili, all in English. What you'll need is 2 pounds or 1 kilogram of beef chopped into small cubes. I used boneless chuck because it can withstand a nice long cooking process, but it's not specific, so really use whatever you want, but boneless chuck works really well. 2 teaspoons of salt, and then 2 types of fat. You got your 1/4 cup or 55 grams of tallow, that's rendered beef fat, and 2 tablespoons or about 30 grams of lard, and that's rendered pork fat. Then 1 cup of minced onion, 3 tablespoons of Gephardt's Eagle chili powder. You can use any chili powder, but this is Gephardt's. It's still around, and they say it's the same as it was. I'm going to guess that there are some little additives, but overall the flavor should be the same. And 2 tablespoons of minced garlic. So first mix the beef and the tallow together, then season with the salt, and then melt the lard in a pot and add in the onions. Now this is a lot more fat than one usually uses to fry onions, and frankly you'll notice that this entire chili is rather fat laden, but you know, it's from Texas, so go big or go home. Let the onions fry for about 5 minutes, moving them around so they don't burn, and then add in the meat. You want to keep turning the meat over to let most of it get a little sear on the bottom of the pot, and then once everything has some color, just leave it be, stirring it only every few minutes. The tallow and all of the fat from the beef itself will melt, and you will marvel at the amount of fat in the pot, but it reduces down, and finally you're left with just enough fat that it barely covers the bottom of the pot. Once it's there, you can add 3 cups or 700 milliliters of hot water, and make sure it's hot, almost boiling. Then add in the garlic, and finally the chili powder, and stir until everything is well mixed in. Then let the pot come to a boil and lower the heat and simmer with the lid off for about an hour to an hour and a half. It really depends on the heat and exactly what meat you're using. Mine took about an hour to get the meat nice and tender. And you shouldn't have to add any more water. It does reduce down, but you also don't want all of the water to evaporate because then you'll just burn it. So keep an eye on it. And while you do, let me tell you about the history of chili and its Texas queens. Now, when it comes to the origins of chili, there are just as many stories as there are versions of chili. But there are some stories which, if not more credible, are at least more entertaining, like the one about the Spanish teleporting nun. Yes, it was the 17th century, and Sister Mary of Agreda in Spain kept falling into catatonic trances for days at a time. And whenever she would wake up, she would claim that she had sent her soul to some far-off distant lands, similar to the way that Luke Skywalker did that force projection thing in The Last Jedi. But instead of fighting with Kylo Ren, she was spreading the good word. It was only later that Spanish missionaries came to believe that Sister Mary was actually the Lady in Blue, or La Dama de Azul. This was a blue woman who often appeared in the folk tales of the Native Americans of the area, and the Spanish, when they came in contact and heard these tales, just assumed it was Mary. And it seems that Mary didn't just spread the good word, but she also spread different recipes, like one for a stew made with antelope or venison, tomatoes, and chili peppers.
Sure, Jan.
Now, a somewhat more credible story is that of the 56 immigrants from the Spanish Canary Islands, who in 1731 settled in the small Texas town of San Fernando de Béjar, modern-day San Antonio. And it's said that these Spanish settlers brought with them a dish of Moroccan descent, because many of the people in the Canary Islands were of Moroccan descent, and it was a stew that had cumin in it, and that eventually became chili con carne. And maybe that's true, except that cumin doesn't really appear in any of the earlier versions of chili con carne, not really until the 20th century, so doesn't make a lot of sense. And cumin or no, chili was already a thing in the Americas. Stewing meat with chili peppers had kind of been a thing for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. In fact, at the same time as those 56 Canary Island immigrants came, there was a Swiss Jesuit missionary named Philip Zegesa who wrote that he saw the native people of southern Arizona, my home turf, roasting chili peppers and then grinding them up into a powder and using them to flavor a stew of meat that had been fried in fat. That's chili. It just wasn't called chili. That wouldn't happen until the late 19th century. In 1857, there was a book published called Chili con Carne, or The Camp and the Field, by S. Compton Smith. It followed his experiences during the Mexican-American War in 1847 and 48, and it seems that chili was an extremely popular dish amongst both the American and the Mexican armies at the time. He describes it as a popular Mexican dish, literally red pepper and meat. Pretty simple. And he has a wonderful story about this time that the Americans snuck up on an encampment of Mexican soldiers, and they did so fast that the Mexicans fled and hid and left their entire camp behind. But what was most interesting to our hungry fellows, of all the camp equipage they left behind were their steaming pots of chili con carne, which in their hurry to Vamos, they had left upon the embers. So of course the American troops start chowing down on the chili. But then a group of women who had been with the Mexican army, also hiding, but who had been the ones doing most of the cooking, well, when they saw the Americans eating up all of their hard work, the enemy sitting down to the meal that they had just prepared, they came back into camp, grabbed the chili pots, and took it back. And the Americans, a little upset that their chili was now gone, which wasn't theirs, they said that, you know, the fact that these women did that, it was so entertaining to them that it almost made up for the lack of chili. And that was only the start of the U.S. military's involvement with chili, because in 1882, it was announced that the Secretary of War ordered the Inspector General of the Army to place on the supply list for the use of the Army the Americanized Mexican food, chili con carne. It has been recommended by officers of the Army as a most valuable diet and for its anti-scorbutic properties. And it's true that chili can ward off scurvy because the vitamin C content in a chili pepper is actually more than in the same amount of an orange, which is probably also why the cowboys of the American West were eating chili because they didn't have a lot of access to fresh fruit. As far back as the 1850s, there are stories of cowboys all over the American Southwest creating a sort of portable chili. They would take dried meat, fat, and chili peppers and kind of press them into bricks, similar to the pemmican that I made last fall. And it was just spicier, but then they could take it and put it into hot water and rehydrate it to make a fresh pot of chili. Ingenious. Then in 1881, William Gerard Tobin, a former Texas Ranger, improved the dried chili brick by creating the first canned chili, which he sold en masse to the U.S. Army and Navy. And in 1884, he opened a factory that was going to make a lot of chili using goat meat, but he died soon after and the whole thing kind of fell apart. It turns out that people weren't really into goat meat chili. It's almost as bad as the turkey chili that my mom used to pass off to us, and just needs to be beef. And it was beef that became the de facto meat used in San Antonio by the Chili Queens. So the Chili Queens were the name given to the women who sold all manner of chili-flavored foods in the plazas of San Antonio during the late 19th and early 20th century. The fat, tawny Mexican mutter familias will place before you various savory compounds, swimming in fiery pepper, which biteth like a serpent. That quote from 1874 was actually describing a bowl of chili and other chili-flavored foods that were served in the houses of these women, but it was the same food also prepared in those houses that then they would take out and serve in the plazas. When visiting San Antonio in 1895, Stephen Crane, author of The Red Badge of Courage, wrote, "Upon one of the plazas, Mexican vendors with open-air stands sell food that tastes exactly like pounded fire brick from Hades. Chili con carne, tamales, enchiladas, chili verde, frijoles." He dubbed these plazas the social shrines of the people of San Antonio. And while he describes the frijoles, or beans, as kind of being a separate thing from the chili, an Alabama reporter from 1881 described San Antonio chili as composed of small bits of beef, beans, and cayenne pepper. Which sounds like the beans were in the chili, a cardinal sin in Texas today. Now these chili queens became a sort of tourist attraction for people visiting the city in the early 20th century, and there are descriptions of hundreds of tables being set up as the women came into the plaza with brightly painted wagons full of chili that they had made at home. They'd build mesquite fires to keep the chili warm as they dished it up for their customers, and sometimes, along with the chili queens themselves, dancers and musicians would come in to entertain people as they ate their chili. But as most of the population appreciated the Chili Queens and kind of saw them as a staple of the city, the upper crust of San Antonio thought of them more as a nuisance and slowly pushed them out of different plazas until finally they were relegated to Haymarket Square. Then in September of 1937, recent action of the City Health Department in ordering removal from Haymarket Square of the Chili Queens and their stands brought an end to a 200-year-old tradition. With the disappearance from the plaza of the chili stands, the troubadours, who roamed the plaza for years, also have disappeared into the night. There was a public outcry, and a couple of years later, the Chili Queens were allowed to come back, but only for about a year before, again, the City Health Department shut them down, and they never returned. But the legacy of the Chili Queens did carry on, because the famous Bolo Red, as some have called it, became widely popular all over the United States. Some had become familiar with the dish via military service, but it gained mainstream popularity when bowls of chili con carne were served to visitors of the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893. And a couple years later, a German immigrant, Willy Gebhardt, invented a shelf-stable chili powder when he ran the Phoenix Cafe in a small town outside of San Antonio. This cafe was actually a rough-and-tumble saloon that featured an alligator pit and a place to host badger fights. He had also had a parrot on a perch near the door, which he had taught to say, "Have you paid your bill?" but in German, which is definitely more intimidating than if it had been in English. But while the parrot and badger fights are long gone, the chili powder still persists. It made making chili so much easier that it ended up becoming the flavor associated with most chili in most of the US. But while Gebhardt's chili powder may have become the identifiable flavor of most chili, everything else about the recipe just kinda went off the rails, and people started adding things like tomatoes and corn, potatoes, and sometimes even sweet chilies. And in Cincinnati, a version of the dish that is more reminiscent of a Mediterranean meat sauce is served atop spaghetti with cheddar cheese. But there are so many types of chili around today that I really can't go through them all. But that's also what makes things like a chili cook-off so much fun. Hundreds of different recipes all coming together to vie for the top chili spot, sometimes trying to out-hot each other, and some people are really proud to be able to eat those hot chilies. Like Homer attempting to eat Chief Wiggum's chili, which featured
the merciless peppers of Quetzalcoatlanango.
But I personally have never been too partial to anything extremely spicy, so let's just see if I can withstand this chili recipe from 1910. And here we are, Gebhardt's San Antonio-style chili. Now, usually I like to eat my chili with some cornbread, but most of the descriptions from the late 19th and early 20th century say that, at least in Texas, it was served with beans and tortillas. So I got some corn tortillas to eat it with, but first let me try it just a piece itself. It smells really, really good. Can really smell that chili powder, though. And it is quite fatty, but here we go. Wow. That's really good. All right, there's a little kick at the end. Takes a second. But it's not super hot. I thought it would be because the amount of chili powder in it is like 50% more than the Gebhardt's recipe from today. So I kind of figured, but I don't know. It's not that hot. There's definitely spice to it, but it's not like overwhelming. But yeah, this would make actually like really good soft tacos. Maybe that's what I'll have to eat tonight. I also think that this is going to taste even better tomorrow because like so many stews or things like that, it just gets better with a day in the fridge and then reheat it. The flavors all really come together. So yeah, make sure that you have checked out the Tasting History Cookbook if you haven't yet. And yeah, that's all I got. I will see you next time on Tasting History. I'm gonna eat more of this right now because it's good.